Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. It's Saturday, August 22nd, 2009, and I'm so happy to be with you today. Good morning to my friends in Florida listening on the Eagle 104.3 FM. And good morning to my friends listening on the web at lwrn.net. Given the many blessings bestowed upon our country, I dedicate every show to our Father in Heaven. So we'll start the show by praying as Jesus instructed us in Matthew chapter 6. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Well, our country is in deep trouble, and I urge everyone to fervently pray for God's blessings on our country. Let's redouble our efforts to obey His commandments, especially refraining from taking the Lord's name in vain. Coming to you live, courtesy of Liberty Works Radio Network. Liberty works. Of course it does. We really need your help here to keep Liberty Works Radio Network on the air. So I invite you to visit lwrn.net. That's the Liberty Works Radio Network website, lwrn.net, and click on Join Donate. I always encourage my listeners to have a pen and paper handy so that you can copy down important information that we'll be providing to you on the show. For those that are new to the show, I'm a former IRS Criminal Investigation Division Special Agent. I no longer work for the IRS because during the last 2 years of my service there, I investigated claims and research others had made about the legality of the IRS administration and enforcement of the federal income tax system. And I couldn't help but conclude that many of those claims were actually true, namely that the tax laws passed by the Congress do not require most Americans to file income tax returns and pay federal income tax. So coming to this conclusion obviously cut my IRS career short. And I've been speaking about my experiences and conclusions regarding the federal income tax and other liberty-related matters ever since. I also want to announce, I did last week as well, that a member of the Front Sight Firearms Training Institute has offered to fill open slots for an upcoming 4-day practical rifle training class at Front Sight. And he's making that open to friends and supporters of the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. So that member suggested the following arrangement, subject to class size considerations. Any person who would be willing to donate $200 of financial support to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show will receive a formal invitation to participate in a 4-day practical rifle training class at the Front Sight Firearms Training Facility in Pahrump, Nevada. That's about 45 minutes northwest of Las Vegas. Invitees would be responsible for their own travel, lodging, ammunition expenses, and you have to either bring your own rifle or rent one at Front Sight. And it's about a $100 rental fee for all 4 days. You can get more information about Front Sight at frontsight.com. That's frontsight.com. The class is scheduled for Friday, the 25th, through Monday, the 28th of September. So you still have a little bit of time. I believe the deadline for signing up is September 11th, coming up in the next month. If you're interested, you can go to josephbannister.com. That's J-O-S-E-P-H, Joseph Bannister, B-A-N-I-S-T-E-R, josephbannister.com. Click on the Contact Us menu item and send an email that has rifle class in the subject box. That way we'll know that you're a serious inquiry about the class. And, of course, when the class is full, it's full, so don't delay if you'd like some of the best firearms training available anywhere in the USA. Well, my guest this morning is Idaho State Representative Phil Hart. Representative Hart is a Kootenai County businessman. He'll have to tell me if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He owns and operates Alpine Engineering in Hayden, Idaho, and is a licensed civil structural engineer in 11 states. He has a daughter named Sarah, and believes his greatest role in life is as a father. Good for you, Phil. Phil holds a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from the University of Utah and an MBA from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. He served for 7 years on the Remington Water District Board of Directors and served as its chairman. And he recently completed his second term in the Idaho House of Representatives. In addition to being active in the political arena, Phil Hart is a competitor on the athletic field and in business. He has competed at the national level in cycling and has won 2 World Cup races. Phil, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for coming on. We thought we might run into a little technical difficulty, but I believe we're being heard by the listeners, many in Florida and around the world on the internet. So I guess what I'd like you to do, Phil, is explain a little bit more about yourself, especially if any of that bio that you have on your website is old in any way. And then explain to the listeners what prompted you to write your book, Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any?
Sure, Joe. Well, I got my start in politics, I guess, when I was 8 years old. My parents had me going door-to-door for Barry Goldwater, and I remember doing it. I remember hanging literature on the doorknobs. I remember arguing with my third-grade friends why Barry Goldwater was a better choice, and after that, my family was involved in a lot of campaigns, and we stuffed a lot of envelopes, and my parents would pick up causes on their own, and we had a mimeograph machine, and we'd make these flyers and pass them out. It might have been a local issue, or it might have been a national issue, but they were pretty active. So it was really kind of my part of my family culture to pay attention to what was going on in the world around us, and to see what we could do to influence that. So it was something that we talked about all the time, talked about at the dinner table, politics, and paid attention to what was going on in the world, to see what we could do about it. So that was always fun, and as I kind of grew up, off and on, I would get myself involved in a political campaign or two, and I had a few years of my life where I moved around quite a bit and kind of precluded myself from getting too involved, but I'm glad to be back someplace where I put some roots down, and I live in a conservative area. I'm pretty like-minded with my neighbors, and I guess they thought so because they elected me to represent them down in the capital of Idaho, which is down in Boise, and I've enjoyed that very much. With regard to the athletics, what I did is in alpine ski racing, I won 2 World Cup races, but that was for the old folks. That was for the 30-year-old plus guys, but some of them are still pretty fast, so I guess that was still somewhat of a feat, but I enjoy skiing, and that's, I guess, what kept me in the mountains and in the northern latitudes of our country.
So, and you're currently still serving as a legislator, correctly?
That's right, Joe. I'm in my third term, and we run for re-election every 2 years, so it's almost like you're campaigning all the time, but I guess it's good because that keeps in contact with the people, and the process that I've enjoyed, it's been a really big learning process about how to do things politically and what needs to happen. And there's probably about 1 million issues that we need to address at any given time, but of course we can't put that much on our plate. So the issues that rise to the top are really the ones that the people are talking about and the people are concerned about and agitating about and being politically active about, the people play actually a big role in that process of what we put on our plate and what we try to handle down in the state capital of Idaho.
Well, I guess being in the state capital and probably being of the
mindset and persuasion that you are. You haven't had to face any of those angry voters like the federal legislators have.
Well, we're somewhat independent in Idaho, there are folks that want the government to be the great nanny in the sky, but they don't prevail. You know, usually we try to keep government small and efficient, and we would never put anything on the agenda like this healthcare plan that they're doing back in Washington, D.C.
I see. Well, we have just a few minutes before the first break, but could you just briefly, certainly when we come back in more detail, but just briefly describe your book, almost like a back jacket description of it. And then, like I say, I may have to let you know when the break's about here, but like I just found it absolutely fascinating book, and I don't just say that because you're the guest on the show. I mean, just an incredible history lesson on this federal income tax system and what was really going on when it first came into being. So with that, please give us a brief intro to the book.
Well, Joe, I'd heard off and on that there were issues with the legality of the income tax, and I kind of discounted those, and then they kept seeming to come back, and I'd hear more about it. And so I started doing my own research, kind of like you did, and I got pretty deeply into it realized that there was some credibility there. And I started reading the Internal Revenue Code, which was very complicated, and the thought crossed my mind that maybe an easier way to understand the income tax was not to read the Internal Revenue Code, which in my mind was deliberately confusing, but to research the historical record and to find out what was the intent of Congress, what was the intent of the American people when they decided that they were going to add this provision, the 16th Amendment, to our Constitution. So I started reading in the congressional record to figure out what was Congress trying to do? Because in all the reading I'd done through the literature at that time on the income tax, I'd only seen a couple of references to the congressional record. So it seemed to me it was fertile ground to be researched, was to look into that aspect of the issue. And so I set out to discover what it was the American people were trying to do when they were debating this income tax amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, because your book, again, it's called Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any?, which I think is an awesome title, because nowadays people think that income is nearly everything under the sun, and they probably think that because that's what the IRS tells them is the case, but the research in your book tells quite a different story, and I really encourage people to get a copy of the book. Maybe just tell people your website. That way, during the break, those listeners on the Internet might even be able to check it out.
Sure. The website is www.constitutionalincome.com.
Okay. And then is there any particular place, because we got about 20 seconds before the break, any particular place on there where there's a brief synopsis of the book?
Well, there's the first chapter's there is a summary of the book, and it's probably about 10 pages on that website, so you might just surf around it and have a look at it.
Okay, constitutionalincome.com?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Well, our guest is Phil Hart. He's a legislator, a representative in the Idaho legislature, and an author of what I consider to be an incredible book called Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? So when we come back after the break, we're going to dig right into the book and the author and give you a good idea about some things that happened long, long ago but are very relevant today. We'll be right back.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Norman Rockwell didn't create the best in us. He just inspired the best. You've seen the paintings. the Thanksgiving turkey being served at Grandma's. The weathered farmer sending his baby-faced son off to college.
Now be sure and write.
The wise police officer sitting at the soda bar, talking a young boy out of running away from home.
Where are you going?
Norman Rockwell didn't create the best in us. He just inspired the best. Inspiration. Pass it on.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Liberty Works Radio Network.
It's the truth that no one else will say on the radio.
The philosophy of Barack Obama is predicated on one simple notion, and that's that it's okay to take from one person to give to another.
It's okay to take from one person to give to another.
He's the evil conservative saying what America's thinking.
Barney Frank, Tim Geithner, Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid. I want to know who's controlling these Muppets. Who's controlling these Muppets?
Truth to power.
It's the truth that no one else will say on the radio.
Only one man can do it. The evil conservative.
Listen, it'd be really easy to get rid of all the questions. Just show us the birth certificate.
He's the evil conservative.
Listen, sometimes somebody just has to say, it's an ugly baby.
Get it right.
Yes,
the evil truth. The evil conservative saying what America's thinking.
Weeknights at 10 on Liberty Works Radio Network, on Blog Talk Radio, and on Eagle 104.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Shut up is the central rationale behind the leftist program. We've heard it expanded upon recently by Democrat bigwigs who want to bring back some version of the misnamed fairness doctrine to try to knock guys off the air. But even if the left can't turn shut up into law, they've worked hard over the years to make it the custom of the country. It's the essence of politically correct phraseology and university speech codes. Say it our way or shut up. It's inherent in the media's demonization of conservative commentators, the way they try to turn names like Limbaugh and Ann Coulter into bywords for intolerance so they'll just shut up. And why were there more than half a dozen movies attacking the war on terror and not one in support of it? Oh, wait, I know. Shut up. The left here has been making the shut-up argument at least since the 70s, when it became clear that all their other arguments had failed. Since it was the only argument remaining to them, they had to invent different ways to say it. If you pointed out that their weakness allowed the murderous tyranny of communism to expand, for instance, well, you were a McCarthyite. Shut up. If you proved that their leniency toward criminals turned our cities into cesspools, you were a fascist. Shut up. When you pointed out that their welfare policies destroyed black families and created a social disaster of vast proportions, you were a racist, a sexist, uncivil, worse than Hitler. All just different ways of saying, shut up. All around the world, as leftism has failed everywhere, shut-uppery has been called to its defense. The full-blown leftists, the communists, say shut up with prisons and guns. But the Western leftists, laboring under traditions of freedom, are subtle. In Europe, they've had more than 50 years of the sort of soft socialism the Democrats are now bringing here. Their anti-individualist, anti-religious, anti-patriotic policies have so sapped the energies of the European nations that the continent's once great cultures are now flaccid and passive, fit for nothing but to be conquered in slow motion by the violent, intolerant Islamist invader within. But when people like Ayn Hirsi Ali, Geert Wilders, or Oriana Fallaci have the temerity to decry the left's empowerment of Islamist hatefulness, they're the ones brought up on charges of being hateful. Not because they're speaking falsely, mind you, but because, shut up. So now, the left is in charge of America. And shut up is on the march. Watch for that fairness doctrine. Beware of net neutrality. Pay attention to the ways the liberal mainstream news media distort, mock, insult, and exclude the conservative opposition. Listen to the people they don't want you to listen to. Whatever you do, don't shut up. Don't shut up. Don't shut up.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution. Now live from coast to coast and around the globe. More real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. My website is freedomabovefortune.com. You can get on the mailing list there and get the latest information about guests, upcoming guests, and information about the guests that I've had on in the past, trying to share that information with you as much as possible. Our guest is Idaho legislator Phil Hart. He's a representative in the state of Idaho, and I believe he said that he's in his third term. Is that correct, Phil?
Yes, Joe, that's correct.
So I first met Phil, it's been quite a few years, but I was just fascinated with his book called Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? And it's a pretty thick book, but I think it's an excellent book. But what I asked Phil to do now is to just kind of talk about how he dug in to the research and what kind of nuggets he ended up finding, which I'm sure intrigued him to dig even further. So, Phil, why don't you give the listeners an idea about what it's like to research a book like that?
Well, Joe, I started thinking about it, and I started wondering, well, you know, what was the definition of income in the Constitution? And, you know, we've gone to great lengths to figure out what the definition of religion is in the First Amendment or speech or what the definition of a firearm is in the Second Amendment. And I remember asking a few people who I considered constitutional scholars, you know, well, what's the definition of income? And I remember one fellow said, well, I don't think anybody's ever really looked at that. And so when I did my reading in the kind of the contemporary literature on the legality of the income tax, I'd only seen two or three references out of the congressional record. So I thought that was a good place to start because it seemed like nobody had really paid much attention to what was in the congressional record. So I went to a local law library, and the congressional record is going to be found in any good law library around the country. And it took me about a couple of days just to work my way through the index and copy all the debates in those volumes of the congressional record. And the index will cover every subject that Congress might have addressed in a given year. And so what I was looking for was the debates that Congress had on the income tax amendment, that would be the 16th Amendment, during 1909 through 1913 period. So after spending a few days just photocopying the debates, I spent about another 200 hours reading my way through them. And it was really very fascinating, and I'm convinced that you can get a pretty good idea about what's going on in America just by reading the debates in Congress. At least back then, you could. And so that kind of started me on a process of trying to dig back into history and figure out what the American people, what the Congress was talking about when they debated the 16th Amendment. And so I was, at that point, I would think I was on a mission, and I just looked in every place I could think of. And so I looked through all the law journal articles I could find, and you know, I looked through the digest, and that's a kind of a legal summary reference book where there's digest geographically and digests on different issues. But I looked through the digest for any law journal articles I could find on the income tax. But I also just would walk down the shelves of law library and look for the law journals that have been published for over 100 years, and looked at that 1909 and 1913 period, and just grabbed books off the shelf to see if there's anything in there on the income tax. And I came up with about 75 law journal articles over from that time period that talked about taxation and particularly the income tax. And so then I did the same thing with political economy journals and economic journals and a few accounting journals, and quite a bit of this research I did back in Washington, D.C. at the Library of Congress, and looking for any kind of publication I could find that addressed the income tax issue. And I included some magazine articles also. Then I went to the New York Times, and now the New York Times is what we call a newspaper record, and it'll Times also puts out an annual yearbook, and in that yearbook they've got a reference to every article they wrote during the year. And so I found about 300 articles on the income tax over that about 4-year period of time. So I photocopied all those. I ended up with quite a large volume of material, you know, several tens of thousands of pages of material that I went through doing the research on just trying to figure out, you know, what was it Congress was trying to do, and what was the debate all about with reference to the income tax amendment, which was being debated in Congress and around the country.
But ultimately, you were... We're talking about one word, income, which you know, the IRS claims that it's a slam dunk, no need to look it up, but all that for one word, and that's why, see, that's why I'm telling my listeners how fascinated I am with your book. So, okay.
Well, you know, Congress can't define that word income, and actually neither can the IRS, because that is the word that appears in the Constitution. Congress gets its power from the Constitution, and if Congress could define the meanings of the word in the Constitution, I mean, they might say that you know, we're going to elect our representatives every 2 years, and they might define a year as, you know, 3,650 days, and that means you get elected to Congress, and 20 years go by before you're up for re-election. So Congress cannot define words in the Constitution. So we have to look somewhere else for that definition. And the Supreme Court has told us in some of their rulings that we have to look to what was in the minds of the people, you know, both when the Constitution was written to determine what the original intent was, and also when the 16th Amendment was drafted to determine what the original intent of that amendment was, too.
So the Supreme Court does have the power to define it by basically interpreting, or its job, its delegated duty to interpret the law?
Well, that's right. And, you know, the Constitution says that all controversies can come before the Supreme Court. And that's another place where I went to do my research. And so I went to the Supreme Court library. There's a public part of that library where anybody can walk in and request any kind of material that might be in the archives. Court, and I got what was called the transcript of record for about 25 cases that related to the income tax amendment around that 1913 to maybe about 1925 period where the court was going over this. And when I got the transcript of record, what I got was not just the Supreme Court's opinion that you can find in any good law library, but also the original complaint for the cases, the briefs, the oral arguments, the motions. And I went through that, and I found that it was much easier to understand the case, of course, when you read the briefs and the oral arguments in addition to reading the opinion itself. So that was a lot of photocopying. I mean, I spent several thousand dollars just on photocopies, and at times I felt like I was in Las Vegas at a slot machine just feeding money into this machine, and all I was getting back were, I didn't get any jackpots. Well, actually, I did get some jackpots in terms of what I discovered, but it was a lot. There were a lot of hours there just standing in front of the copy machine, and I'll tell you, when I got those Supreme Court transcripts of records, many of those volumes, they're typically leather bound. You might have one case in a volume, which could be up to say 700 pages thick, or you might have three or four cases, depending on, you know, just how thick the Supreme Court's file was. But those volumes were leather bound, and many of them had never been opened ever. I was the first guy to open those books up and photocopy them, and so I had my daughter help me for a couple of days of doing that down at the Library of Congress, and we made a mess out of the photocopy machine because the leather would chip off and the binding in, you know, a couple of the volumes flaked off because no one had ever opened these books before, and they were 80, 90 years old.
That's incredible. I mean, that's kind of one of the questions I was about to ask you was what it would be like. And, you know, there must have been some old librarian there that was like, you want to see what?
Well, I did get to know a couple of them. I mean, I probably have been to the Library of Congress now about 15 different times doing research.
So that's definitely the place to go. And you can't get probably a more legitimate source for the kind of research that you were doing.
Well, one place I did go for research was the reading room at the IRS, which was in Washington, D.C. And I guess I was naive at the time because, you know, I discovered that all the state agencies have a reading room because, you know, we're a government of the people, for the people, and by the people. And, you know, one provision in our Constitution is that Congress will keep a journal and shall publish the same from time to time. And so we have this requirement that there be this openness, that virtually anything that our government does, there's got to be a paper trail. It's got to be something that we can discover. And so every agency of the federal government has what they call a public reading room. And I had it in my head that the public reading room for the IRS would be about as big as a football field. Because I thought, well, this thing applies to, you know, 200, 300 million Americans, and all these Americans would want to do research, and there would be this gigantic reading room where they could come and do research. But what I found was that the reading room for the IRS, it was just, I don't know, maybe only 600-700 square feet. Maybe it was 1,000 square feet. It was this really odd-shaped, kind of pie-shaped room that had obviously was leftover space, and all the kind of the public volumes for their various manuals were in there, and they were not that well organized, and the shelves were 10 or so feet high, and sometimes you need the ladder. And the couple of times that I was in there, I don't know if I saw more than two or three people, and I remember I bought some manuals, and I remember the gal who was helping me, who was actually a very nice woman, she didn't know how to sell them to me, because I guess not that many people go in there and actually buy a manual. So I was pretty disappointed that we didn't have, you know, hundreds of Americans on a daily basis down there trying to figure out the law.
But you were there, thankfully. Thanks be to God that you decided to give it a try. And, probably no one came before you and no one's come in since. Now they can just read your books and rather than taking a trip. But I'm sure the IRS did treat that reading room as kind of a bastard child. Having worked there myself, I know that the things that don't matter to the IRS, they don't expend a lot of money or resources towards. And something like documenting, you know, what they do to the American public is certainly a bastard child to them. Well, let's see. Okay, well, we're just about to go to a break, so I hate to get you launched into the next segment of your presentation. So maybe I'll just tell the listeners again, for those who can check on the internet during the break, the website is constitutionalincome.com. Our guest is Idaho legislator Phil Hart. He's serving his third term in the Idaho legislature. And this book, Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any?, is what we're talking about, and the research that brought it to its existence. And so we'll be back shortly with our guest, Phil Hart, and I really appreciate you joining us.
Freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in Broadcasting.
He went without food, not to lose weight, but to help people lose generations of hate.
While many around him rose up with violence, he sat down for peace. When others used religion as an excuse for war, he used it to remind them of love. Mahatma Gandhi made the world a far better place by reaching out with the strength he cultivated within his soul. Soul, pass it on.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Join the Cavalcade to Freedom. The Cavalcade back to constitutional government. Climb on board and do your part to proclaiming liberty throughout the land. Join and support Liberty Works Radio Network Fellowship. To view the strategic plan, to spread the word, and to get information on joining, go to www.libertyworksradionetwork.com or call the fellowship office at 410-857-5444. That's 410-857-5444. To join the Cavalcade to Freedom. America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network.
There's a reason education's because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. It's the big, wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the... They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they get by a system that threw them overboard. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
She knows a hollow from a double up. She does snapbacks, backsides, shoots the curl. Bethany Hamilton knows everything about surfing. She just didn't know about the shark. But just months after the attack, and with only one arm, the 13-year-old surfs again. And now she's ripping it better than ever. So next time life puts a little fear in you, just think of Bethany Hamilton hanging 10 on top of a heavy wave. That's real courage. Pass it on.
Now live from coast to coast and around the globe, more real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show.
Our guest today is Representative Phil Hart from the Idaho Legislature. And I also mentioned during, at the beginning of the show, that Phil is an engineer. And so in case anyone out there is looking for an honorable engineer who also knows quite a bit about tax history and legislating, you can go to alpineengineering.com. That would be Phil's engineering firm. They specialize in structural engineering, but Phil said they do a little bit of civil engineering, and they also perform forensic engineering work. So if there's a lawsuit or something where basically an investigative engineering needs to be done, they'd be the ones to contact as well. So that's alpineengineering.com. Again, our guest is Phil Hart. And Phil, you were talking about the volume of research materials that you had to generate and what you had to do to generate that. So why don't we get into some of the things that you found, the oh wows and look at this type items that you came across once you started to digest those materials.
Well, Joe, since you just mentioned engineering, let me make the point that, you know, you and I have been activistic on the income tax issue now for, 10 or so years, and in that process we've been to a lot of meetings, some conventions, we've done a few projects together, and we've met a lot of other people who are activistic on the issue, and the ones that have taken kind of a leadership role or have moved the ball in the direction of liberty and freedom and constitutional law, there's a lot of engineers, and some of those engineers became lawyers too, and that, have that dual background. But this is a complicated issue, and it really requires some kind of problem solving skills. And an engineer, when he solves a problem, I mean, he has to deal with reality. He has to deal with laws of nature, and electrons moving through a wire, they're predictable, and the force of gravity is predictable, and you have to deal with those realities. You can't lie your way through, say, the design of a structure, because when the earthquake comes, it's going to find all your deceptions, and it's going to expose everything that wasn't done right when the building collapses. And so there's kind of a mindset among an engineer that when they research something, when they try to put something together, it has to work and it has to make sense. Well, so back to your question, what did I discover? Well, one kind of a surprising thing I discovered was that the American people were demanding an income tax. I mean, it was a big issue starting around the 1880s, and the American people felt like those people who had incomes, which were a small percentage of the American people, were getting a free ride from government. So what I'm talking about is back during that period of time, the federal government was not the big nanny in the sky, and it didn't take care of every problem, didn't involve itself in every aspect of our lives. In about 1825, the budget for the federal government worked out to about 15 cents per person. And around 1910, when we got the income tax, the budget for the federal government was about $10 per person. And what was going on at the time was the money that it took to run the federal government largely came through the collection of tariffs on imported goods. And the belief was at the time that American industry back then was largely monopolized, and those monopolists who controlled the monopolies, they also had huge influence in Congress, and they managed to get very high tariffs on any imported good to really keep the goods out of the country so that there would be more domestically goods sold. And by keeping that tariff high, they were able to raise the prices on the domestically goods that they produced. And so when the average American went to the store and bought something, 20% of the time they were buying an imported good, and so 20% of the time they were paying a tariff that was going into the U.S. Treasury. But the other 80% of the time, they were paying inflated prices for domestically made goods, and that differential in price, if you might say, the monopolists were able to charge because they were competing against foreign goods that had to pay high tariff. That price differential was going into the profit of the monopolist as a windfall profit. The American people were very angry about it because they didn't mind so much being taxed by their government, but they felt like they were being taxed by the businessman too, and they wanted to do something about it. And the idea was that, well, let's start taxing all of this accumulated wealth, which is represented by the monopolies, so that the accumulated wealth pays for the benefit it receives from government. So you might say, well, what was that benefit? How does wealth benefit from government? Well, we didn't have all these entitlement programs back then, so pretty much all the government did was it protected the borders, it provided a court system to handle controversies and disputes, and we had a U.S. Navy which was out there protecting our overseas investments. And so if you were a Rockefeller or a Carnegie or a Mellon and you were worth $100 million or more than that, you probably had some overseas investments. You were probably benefiting from the existence of the United States Navy. But were you paying for that? No, you weren't, because you're paying about as much taxes as the average working guy, and the only taxes you were paying were the taxes on a pair of shoes you bought, if you bought foreign-made shoes, or taxes on sugar if that sugar was imported. And so the wage earner and the monopolist who was worth many hundreds of millions of dollars were paying about the same amount of tax. But the benefit that the wealthy were receiving was far greater than what the average American was receiving.
I see. So so there was a clamor from the people.
Yeah, there was. And they wanted this income tax. And the objective of the income tax was to bring tax relief to the average working American, because what the plan was, or what the goal was of the people who were agitating for an income tax, was to tax accumulated wealth for the benefit it received from government. And now let me point something out. I'm quoting the quotes out of the Congressional Record. I'm framing this issue the way Congress framed it, the way the American people framed it, the way it was framed in the various literature. They were going to tax accumulated wealth. They were going to tax people. They were going to tax the wealth that produced an income. And so if you had a big investment, and that investment was, I don't know, let's say it was in the form of cash or gold, and let's say you hid it in your mattress, that would produce no income because it was not generating any kind of profit. It wasn't generating any kind of interest being in a bank account. So the income tax is only to tax the gain that existing wealth was generating, or the income. And so we weren't even going to tax people with the income tax. We were just going to tax accumulated wealth.
So it would be it would seem kind of common sense that the you're documenting, or you've documented, that there was a clamor for the income tax, but it wasn't a bunch of people clamoring to say, let's tax us people more. They got the picture in terms of who was benefiting and who wasn't, and so the clamor was that there be an income tax. But at that time in American history, the people seemed to have a little better vocabulary, and they understood what income was, which you're going to be describing to us.
Yes. I mean, can you imagine today that we would have single moms who were waitresses in a restaurant that were going to Congress and demanding that their tips be taxed, and that their, you know, $4 an hour they might make as a waitress, that get taxed? I mean, it wouldn't happen today, and it would have been no different back then, that the people weren't saying tax my paycheck, tax my wages. They were after the accumulated wealth, which was really getting a free ride. And as I read the Congressional Record and all those debates, I didn't get a sense that there was any kind of a soak the rich mentality, because back then there was this philosophy that prevailed among the people that when you paid taxes to government, there was a direct correlation between what you paid and what you got back in terms of services from government. And really, the mindset back then was what government provided was basically protection. It was a an insurance policy. You were paying taxes, and the government was protecting the borders. It was protecting your investments. It was providing for the court system to handle your disputes. And there was a direct relationship between what you paid in and what you got back. I got to hand it to the American people. That's the way it should be, and I can respect that.
And it sounds like the public got it. They understood, because of course that same public would have been heirs of ancestors who set up the Constitution to be for that purpose, and for limited government. And so Americans in the early 1900s got that message and lived by that message.
That's right. And, the income tax debate started in the 1880s, and that's when I think the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed about then. It might have been 1892, where they were going to, start taking apart the monopolies. But even though that legislation was passed, really, didn't start getting enforced until about 25, 30 years later. But so the income tax issue was a big issue. In fact, it gave us two amendments to the Constitution. Now, we've had about 2,200 amendments proposed, but we've only had 27 that have been successful. And the two that it gave us was, of course, the income tax amendment, which was the 16th Amendment, but also the 17th Amendment, which did away with the appointment of senators to the Senate by the state legislators, and now we elect senators by popular vote. And the thinking back then was that people were buying their way into the Senate, and the Senate was a type of plutocracy which was protecting those folks who had this accumulated wealth and was blocking an attempt to impose an income tax. And so the American people thought, if we can elect the senators directly, we can get an income tax. And so that was the motive behind the 17th Amendment. So the fact that the income tax gave us two amendments to the Constitution when we've only had 27, that's huge. That means that income tax issue was a very big issue back then. And as the debate kind of raged on, where the 16th Amendment finally got it, its genesis, in my mind, was the 1908 presidential election, and the Democrat Party platform, and the Democrats were pushing for this more than Republicans, but anyway, the Democrat Party platform said, as its plank on the platform for that election, I'll read it here, "We favor an income tax as part of our revenue system, and we urge the submission of a constitutional amendment specifically authorizing Congress to levy and collect a tax upon individual and corporate incomes to the end that wealth may bear its proportionate share of the burdens of the federal government." I'm going to read that last part again. "To the end that wealth may bear its proportional share of the burdens of the federal government." And the wealth they were talking about was the so-called accumulated wealth. It was, existing assets. And the assets, as they threw off income, that income was going to be taxed.
Wow, that's very telling, that quotation as to what the actual intent was. Well, looks like we got a break coming up here. Our guest is Phil Hart, author of Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? If you're able to check over the break, the website is constitutionalincome.com. And we'll be back for the second hour with our guest, Phil Hart. Thanks for joining us.
A Along with Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry was most instrumental in establishing the American dream. Henry made the following plea. The battle, sir, is not for the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. There is no retreat, but in submission and slavery, our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard upon the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable, and let it come. I repeat, sir, let it come. Oh, gentlemen may cry, peace, peace, but there is none. The war has already begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north shall bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Is life so dear and peace so sweet to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Give me liberty or give me death. Patrick Henry, one of the foremost framers of individual and religious freedom, a son of liberty and the American dream.
The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Germany, Japan, and to a lesser extent Britain and Italy were lifted out of the debris of war by the Americans, who poured in billions of dollars and forgave other billions in debt. None of those countries is today paying even the interest on its remaining debts to the United States. When the franc was in danger of collapsing in 1956, it was the Americans who propped it up, and their reward was to be insulted and swindled on the streets of Paris. And I was there.
The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Looking for a good way to help others who are helping others? Let the Eagle 104 advertise your ministry or service organization. Your gift will support this Faith and Freedom broadcast airtime costs at the same time. Come join this Faith and Freedom Given to Others advertising campaign. Contact me, David Allen Carmichael, toll-free, 888-850-1872, or online at faithfreedoms.org.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Shut Up is the central rationale behind the leftist program. We've heard it expanded upon recently by Democrat bigwigs who want to bring back some version of the misnamed fairness doctrine to try to knock guys off the air. But even if the left can't turn Shut Up into law, they've worked hard over the years to make it the custom of the country. It's the essence of politically correct phraseology and university speech codes. Say it our way or shut up. It's inherent in the media's demonization of conservative commentators, the way they try to turn names like Limbaugh and Ann Coulter into bywords for intolerance so they'll just shut up. And why were there more than half a dozen movies attacking the war on terror and not one in support of it? Oh, wait, I know. Shut up. The left here has been making the shut up argument at least since the 70s, when it became clear that all their other arguments had failed. Since it was the only argument remaining to them, they had to invent different ways to say it. If you pointed out that their weakness allowed the murderous tyranny of communism to expand, for instance, well, you were a McCarthyite. Shut up. If you proved that their leniency toward criminals turned our cities into cesspools, you were a fascist. Shut up. When you pointed out that their welfare policies destroyed black families and created a social disaster of vast proportions, you were a racist, a sexist, uncivil, worse than Hitler. All just different ways of saying, shut up. All around the world, as leftism has failed everywhere, shut-uppery has been called to its defense. The full-blown leftists, the communists, say shut up with prisons and guns. But the Western leftists, laboring under traditions of freedom, are suffering. In Europe, they've had more than 50 years of the sort of soft socialism the Democrats are now bringing here. Their anti-individualist, anti-religious, anti-patriotic policies have so sapped the energies of the European nations that the continent's once great cultures are now flaccid and passive, fit for nothing but to be conquered in slow motion by the violent, intolerant Islamist invader within. But when people like Ayn Hirsi Ali, Geert Wilders, or Oriana Fallaci have the temerity to decry the left's empowerment of Islamist hatefulness, they're the ones brought up on charges of being hateful. Not because they're speaking falsely, mind you, but because, shut up. So now, the left is in charge of America, and shut up is on the march. Watch for that fairness doctrine. Beware of net neutrality. Pay attention to the ways the liberal mainstream news media distort, mock, insult, and exclude the conservative opposition. Listen to the people they don't want you to listen to. Whatever you do, don't shut up. Don't shut up. Don't shut up.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network. The viewpoints expressed on Liberty Works Radio Network are not necessarily those of the network, its affiliates, or sponsors. This is Liberty Works Radio Network. Now live from coast to coast and around the globe. More real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. Our guest is Phil Hart. He's a legislator from the Idaho legislature. And we've been speaking over the first hour about his book, Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? His website is constitutionalincome.com. Phil's also an engineer. Specializing in structural engineering and even forensic engineering, if there's some kind of litigation that you might be involved in. The engineering website is alpineengineering.com. And I want to just quickly mention again the rifle course that is going to be offered at the end of September. Basically, a generous individual is giving the opportunity for people to participate in a four-day practical rifle course offered at Front Sight Firearms Training Institute. It would normally cost thousands of dollars to participate in, asking for a $200 donation to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. And you can come for 4 days of some of the best rifle training in the country. And they tout there at the Front Sight Institute that exceeds law enforcement and military standards. I've been through the handgun course there, and of course I spent 5 years as an IRS special agent, so I think I can verify that truly the training is outstanding. So for just your average American who'd like to go out and get trained, it's a wonderful opportunity. So if you're interested in the rifle class, which will be held from September 25th through September 28th, you can go to josephbannister.com. That's J-O-S-E-P-H-B-A-N-I-S-T-E-R, josephbannister.com, and click on the Contact Us menu item and send an email to me and put rifle class in the subject box so that we know that you're interested. And we'll see if we can get you signed up for the class. Anyway, our guest is
Representative Phil Hart from the Idaho Legislature. He's serving his third term in the Idaho Legislature. He's quite an accomplished, he's got degrees. Just got a long resume of great accomplishments that show that he's a very reasoned individual. And as Phil said in the last hour, being an engineer, I'm not an engineer, so here I am describing one, but, they have to be very exacting, and, things have to come together, all the parts have to come together, and not violate any laws of physics or any of the other engineering criteria that must be there, otherwise the structure will fall. And so it's interesting that Phil went and attacked or investigated the federal income tax, similar to what I did, but in a much more in-depth manner. So we are talking about how Phil went about in investigating and researching his book, Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? And at the end of the last hour, I think Phil was describing a statement that had been made by the Democratic leadership in Congress. Isn't that correct, Phil?
Yeah, that's right. And so let's talk about one of the other pieces of the puzzle. We try to write legislation so people can understand it, but the reality is sometimes it gets confusing, sometimes things are not very well thought through, and sometimes the court has to take a law that we put on the books and figure out what the heck were we trying to do and how do you apply this law. Well, one thing that the courts have said, and you can find in this treatise on on what they call statutory construction, is that in order to determine what a law means, if it's not obvious, you go back and you figure out, well, what was the problem the legislature was trying to solve? And that will shed a lot of light on how you interpret the law. Well, the problem that was trying to be solved with the 16th Amendment, the Income Tax Amendment, was the 1895 Supreme Court ruling in the Pollock case. And in 1894, Congress did pass an income tax, and it was very quickly challenged in court. And by 1895, that case got to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said the law was unconstitutional. And what that law was doing was it was taxing the income from property. It was both real estate and personal property, the personal property being stocks and bonds. And what the Supreme Court said was that when you tax the income from property, it's the same as taxing the property. Well, back then, people were more aware of the Constitution and those types of issues. And in the Constitution, we have what's called direct taxes and indirect taxes. And a direct tax is a tax that you've got to pay. There's no way you can work around it. There's no way you can get out of paying it. Congress levies a tax, you got to pay it. So think in terms of a direct tax is a tax on a noun. It's a tax on something that exists. An indirect tax is a tax on a verb. It's a tax on something you do or some choice that you make. And you might choose to go buy gasoline and drive your car. You're going to pay an excise tax on that gasoline. You could have ridden your bicycle. You could have walked. You could have hitchhiked. You could have chosen not to go anywhere and avoided that tax. And so an indirect tax is a tax that you choose to pay by your behavior, by the choices you make. And a direct tax is a tax that you're stuck with. You've got to pay it. You can't get out of it. So the tax in the Pollock case, the 1894 tax, was a tax on the income from property. Well, you have property that is going to throw off an income if you've got that property in commerce. So you could have property that doesn't make any income at all because it's not in commerce, it's not doing anything, and it's just something that exists but doesn't produce any income and therefore would not pay an income tax. Well, when the Supreme Court said in their Pollock ruling that to tax the income from property was the same as taxing the property, and since everybody knows, at least back then, everybody knew that a tax on property was a direct tax, they said that because Congress did not apportion this 1894 income tax, that the whole thing was unconstitutional and they threw it out. Well, in my mind, that was a bad ruling. In my mind, the Supreme Court was wrong. Now, you're not going to get very many lawyers to say the Supreme Court was wrong. I've noticed as they go through law school, they just get sort of programmed that the Supreme Court is always right. And somehow we've got to fit this bad Pollock ruling into the overall scheme of the income tax and make that a working part of the overall argument, which I think leads us down the wrong road and causes us to get confused as to what the income tax is trying to do. But just think about the example I have in my book. Let's say you have two office buildings. They're owned by different people, but they were built by the same contractor, designed by the same architect, identical buildings. One of them is in commerce. One of them is producing an income. Their property manager is renting it out and doing a good job. It's a profitable building. The next, some sort of property, it could not be taxed unless the tax was apportioned. So now, Joe, we probably got to talk about apportionment.
I think you should.
Okay. Well, I said that a direct tax was a tax on a noun, and an indirect tax was a tax on a verb. And so the requirement of the Constitution is that when the direct tax is imposed, that the tax be apportioned among the people in the same way members of Congress are apportioned among the people. In other words, each member of Congress, irregardless what state he's from, represents about the same number of people back in Washington, you know, from his home state as he works in Congress in Washington, D.C. And we, the constitutional requirement is that direct taxes also be apportioned so that each congressional district is paying about the same amount of direct tax, which means every person pays the same amount of direct tax. And so the direct tax was to be equally distributed among the people. It didn't matter if you're rich or poor, you're going to pay the same amount of a direct tax. And the indirect taxes, and I'll note that the term indirect tax doesn't appear in the Constitution, but the people, as they debated it, used that term to describe all the other taxes Congress can impose. Those taxes have to be geographically uniform, so that if you're charging 50 cents of excise tax on a pack of cigarettes in California, you've got to also charge that same 50 cents in New York or any other one of the 50 states. So those were the constitutional rules on how taxes get levied, and when you're taxing property or you're taxing people or you're taxing something that exists, it's a direct tax. Everybody pays the same amount. When you're taxing anything else, the tax has to be uniform. Everybody pays the same rate. And what the Supreme Court did in the Pollock case in 1895 is they took this indirect tax on the profit from an investment, and they called it a direct tax that had to be apportioned. And since the tax in 1894 and 95 was not apportioned, they said it was unconstitutional. And so what the 16th Amendment did is it said, you know, you can't use that logic anymore. You know, this idea that you're going to take the income from property and call that a tax on the property, we're not ever going to go there again. The 16th Amendment says you can't use that logic ever again in the future. So that's why the Supreme Court said in their rulings after the 16th Amendment was supposedly ratified that the 16th Amendment gave Congress no new power. All it did is it clarified how you, what pigeonhole you put an income tax in. And if the income tax has the characteristics of a direct tax, it's pigeonholed in the direct taxation pigeonhole, and it has to be apportioned. If the income tax has the characteristics of an indirect tax, well, then it's an indirect tax, and it has to be uniform. And we can't have an income tax that's a direct tax. And so we probably got to talk a little bit, Joe, about, well, how do we know what an income, a direct and indirect tax is? How do we know that this guy Philhart's paying a tax a direct tax is a tax on a noun, and an indirect tax is a tax on a verb.
Maybe, Phil, what we'll do is, because the break's coming up, let you launch right into that when we come back. You're listening to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. Our guest is Phil Hart. He's a legislator with the Idaho Legislature and author of Constitutional Income. Do you have any? Website, constitutionalincome.com. We'll be back shortly. Thanks for joining us.
Born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The entire world watched. They watch each step down the rungs of that small ladder, one after another, and waited with great anticipation for that last step.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
At that moment, humanity saw the impossible become the possible. And today, the sky is not the limit. Achievement. Pass it on.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Liberty Works Radio Network.
It's the truth that no one else will say on the radio.
philosophy of Barack Obama is predicated on one simple notion, and that's that it's okay to take from one person to give to another.
It's okay to take from one person to give to another.
He's the evil conservative saying what America's thinking.
Barney Frank, Tim Geithner, Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid. I want to know who's controlling these muppets. Who's controlling these muppets?
Truth to power.
It's the truth that no one else will say on the radio.
Only one man can do it. The evil conservative.
Listen, it'd be really easy to get rid of all the questions. Just show us the birth certificate.
He's the evil conservative.
Listen, sometimes somebody just has to say, it's an ugly baby.
Get it right.
Yes, the evil truth.
The evil conservative.
Saying what America's thinking. Weeknights at 10 on Liberty Works Radio Network. On Blonde Talk Radio and on Eagle 104.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network.
There's a reason education's... Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. Big, wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they get by a system that threw them overboard. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network. America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Be with without food, not to lose weight, but to help people lose generations of hate. While many around him rose up with violence, he sat down for peace. When others used religion as an excuse for war, he used it to remind them of love. Mahatma Gandhi made the world a far better place by reaching out with the strength he cultivated within his soul. So, pass it on.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Now live from coast to coast and around the globe, more real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. Our guest is Representative Phil Hart from the Idaho Legislature, serving his third term there. Phil is also the author of a book called Constitutional Income.
Do you have any? And it's a fascinating book. You know, it's thick and takes some effort to get through, but the history there helps give you an excellent perspective as to where we are today and how we got here. So I think it's an instrumental part of any research effort that my listeners should do. So I highly recommend it. Constitutionalincome.com is the website. And before the break, we kind of had to interrupt Phil midstream there as he was continuing with his story. So, Phil, you said you knew where you could begin again, so please do.
Sure, Joe. You know, we don't get to really debate some of this stuff. When we try to determine what the original intent of the Constitution was or the 16th Amendment, all we can do is go back in the historical record and discover what it was, because we can't change the history. And the way our system works is we have to abide by that original intent. And so as I tell you what I discovered, you know, we can't debate it. We just have to accept it. And so we were about to talk about, well, what's a direct tax and what's an indirect tax. And you know, as the 16th Amendment was debated, members of Congress quoted various economists, and most of the economists that they quoted, quoted each one maybe once in the debate, but Adam Smith was quoted 18 times in these income tax debates. And whenever Adam Smith's name came up, and he wrote the book Wealth of Nations that was published in 1776, he spent 11 years writing that book, and by the time the Constitution was ratified in 1789, Adam Smith's book, Wealth of Nations, was in its sixth edition. And whenever Adam Smith's name came up in the income tax debate, it was always with authority. It was always that Adam Smith was the guy who defined what a direct tax and an indirect tax was, and that wasn't an issue that was debated. It was only an issue that was made reference to as Congress debated the income tax. And let me read to you a quote out of Adam Smith's book, Wealth of Nations. Capitation taxes, so far as they are levied upon the lower ranks of people, are direct taxes upon the wages of labor and are attended with all the inconveniences of such taxes. Well, a capitation tax, which is a phrase that's in the Constitution, is a direct tax. It's a tax on wages. It's also a tax on your head, too. We could charge a capitation tax on your wages, or we could charge a tax, the capitation tax on your head, of say just $100 per person. But Congress, when they debated the 16th Amendment, understood that a tax on wages was a capitation tax and was a direct tax. And what the 16th Amendment did is that said that when you're taxing the income from investment, we're not going to let you call that a tax on the underlying investment. And so the 16th Amendment really set up a rule by which we're going to determine what is a direct and an indirect tax. And it did not give government any new power. Well, what's interesting about this is there were actually three versions of the income tax amendment that were proposed, all drafted by the same guy, Senator Brown from Nebraska. And an earlier version of the 16th Amendment was going to give Congress the power to levy a direct tax without forcing it. In other words, that draft of the amendment would have created an exception to the requirement for apportionment. That version of the 16th Amendment kind of fizzled on the Senate floor as it was being debated, because a lot of senators had a problem with, in one place, saying we have to apportion direct taxes, and another place saying that we don't. And the argument was the Constitution would not be in harmony anymore. It would be kind of in conflict among itself. Well, when the 16th Amendment was actually voted on by the Senate, that version of the income tax amendment that would have created the direct tax apportionment exception, that was also voted on, and the Senate voted against it. So the issue was right before the legislature, if you will. The legislature said, no, we don't want to do this. And now, as our system of government works in America, the executive branch is forever barred by doing something that the legislative branch had in front of it and said no to. In other words, the executive executive branch is forever barred from imposing a direct tax that's unapportioned because the Congress said we're not going to do it. But that's not how it plays out today, is it, Joe?
No, it is not.
And I felt like, as I was doing my research for my book, I felt like it was Nehemiah in the Old Testament who had gone back to Jerusalem to rebuild the wall, and as he was rebuilding the wall, he discovered the law. And they didn't even know they had a law, but they ran across it. Well, we're sort of kind of guilty of the same thing today. We don't know our law. And if we don't know our law, you know, how can we expect it to be applied correctly? And if you think about the Constitution, the parts of the Constitution that we respect are the parts that collectively we understand. But the parts of our Constitution we don't pay a lot of attention to, well, you know, they sort of just get ignored.
And yet, this particular issue, I mean, talk about an issue that affects each and every American, you know, that works, that has to, you know, and how many people are like that. You know, they have to, like myself or you, you have to work. You labor in order to survive, in order to live, in order to get that life that the Constitution protects. So,
well, you know, Alan Keyes, he's very articulate if you're familiar with him, and he has said that the income tax is a slave tax. And if you think about it, when it's your wages that are being taxed, it's your right to exist that's being taxed, because you can't exist without working. You cannot exist without making the money to put a roof over your head and to buy clothes and to buy food. And so really, we are taxing our right to exist. And if you think about the entire scheme of the American political system, it's not about taxing our right to exist. That's what we threw off in the old world, where we had this nobility and we had the serfs and we had these political leaders that claim they have the divine right of kings and that God spoke directly to them, but God didn't speak to the average person. And so there was this, you know, different status where the nobility was superior to the average people. You know, we threw off that system. And now we've sort of fallen back into sort of another version of it, where we're taxing our very right to exist with this tax on our wages. And it's, you know, it's as un-American as you can get.
So, if we're trying to kind of encapsulate the, you know, the research that you did, and the, you know, you kind of brought us up to the point of the 16th Amendment being proposed, you know, the various versions. How would you describe the bottom line? I mean, as I understand it, the bottom line is that the income, you know, what people refer to as income today in 2009, is much more broad than the legal definition of income. And the legal definition has been derived from Supreme Court cases in which the subject of what the definition of an income came up. And so the Supreme Court opined on that definition over and over again after the 16th Amendment was allegedly ratified, which is a whole other subject. I've actually had Bill Benson on the show before to talk about his evidence that the 16th Amendment was never ratified. But presuming that it was, or putting aside that it was not ratified, as you said earlier in the show, it did not expand federal taxing power. And
when I wrote my book, I assumed the income tax amendment was ratified, even though I've read Bill Benson's book and I've met Bill, and I think Bill's right, but I assume Bill was wrong for the purposes of writing my book. And what the intent was to tax the income from accumulated wealth. And I think the Brueschaber case shows us where the Congress can go, you know, assuming the income tax was ratified. Brueschaber got a dividend from Union Pacific Railroad. Union Pacific Railroad was a corporation, but as an individual, he was benefiting from his investment in the corporation. A corporation is a privileged entity. Mr. Brueschaber was benefiting from that privileged entity by getting paid dividends on his stock, and those dividends were taxable. So the bottom line of the 16th Amendment salaries of a working person. And so when we tax privileged income, when we tax income that you made by a choice, by an investment, you choose to make yourself subject to that tax, and it also protects our Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights. And that, you know, once you have income and you report it and you pay a tax on it, you know, you can get audited, and you're volunteering into this audit search and seizure sort of status, and you volunteer to have the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, if you will, not apply to that income and that income tax return and that process of getting income, paying a tax on it. But if you're just a working guy and you're making a living by exchanging your time for wages, then a tax on those wages is a direct tax. It's not something that you volunteered into. And it was never the intent of Congress or the American people that a working man's wages would be taxed.
So it's a fair statement then to say, you know, for those that have been listening for the entire show, that you encountered over 300, journal articles, whether it be from law journals, political journals. You looked at all the congressional debates during that time frame of when the income tax was born, in a sense. You have just looked at tens of thousands of pages of documents that occurred and were generated at that time, and even, which is one of the things I liked about your book especially, was like New York Times articles, where the New York Times is opining and describing what's going on during the early 1900s when this income tax was coming into play. And over again, the message is clear that income and the income tax was meant to tax profits and accumulated wealth, and not only was taxing wages not a part of it, but there's plenty of evidence to show that, you know, never intended to be a part of it. And yet here we stand today in 2009, where tens of millions of Americans are paying a tax on their labor to the IRS, in contradiction to all of that evidence that you've uncovered.
That's right, Joe. And in fact, on the front page of the New York Times, I believe the date was August 3rd, 1909, Alabama was reported to be the first state that ratified the Income Tax Amendment. And in those debates, according to this front page New York Times article, the question was asked, would this affect salaries? And the answer was no, the income tax is not going to affect salaries. So there you have the first state to ratify the income tax, reported on the front page of the New York Times to the rest of the country to see, saying we're not going to tax salaries, and we're not going to tax salaries, we're not going to tax wages either with this income tax amendment. And we have gotten far off course. You know, my book, this is not something that I concocted. My book should have been written before I was born by somebody right after World War II, when a lot of Americans were paying an income tax on the wages, and someone should have gone back to the historical record then and figured out whether that was right or wrong. And my book, in writing my book, all I did, kind of as an engineer, was I used these legal research tools that are out there.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
And it's going to be that
Mother Teresa couldn't do it all, but she gave it all. Compassion. She didn't just visit the sick and poor. She moved in with them because they needed help. Mother Teresa couldn't do it all, but she gave it all. Compassion. Pass it on.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Think.
Is Liberty Works Radio Network enlightening you to the real problems we face in our constitutional republic? Has it helped you to better understand what has to be done to save America from becoming a third world nation? If so, do your part in spreading this voice of truth and enlightenment to your fellow Americans. Join the Liberty Works Radio Network Fellowship. Go to www.libertyworksradionetwork.com for details.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Shut Up is the central rationale behind the leftist program. We've heard it expanded upon recently by Democrat bigwigs who want to bring back some version of the misnamed fairness doctrine to try to knock guys off the air. But even if the left can't turn Shut Up into law, they've worked hard over the years to make it the custom of the country. It's the essence of politically correct phraseology and university speech codes. Say it our way or shut up. It's inherent in the media's demonization of conservative commentators, the way they try to turn names like Limbaugh and Ann Coulter into bywords for intolerance so they'll just shut up. And why were there more than half a dozen movies attacking the war on terror and not one in support of it? Oh, wait, I know. Shut up. The left here has been making the shut up argument at least since the 70s, when it became clear that all their other arguments had failed. Since it was the only argument remaining to them, they had to invent different ways to say it. If you pointed out that their weakness allowed the murderous tyranny of communism to expand, for instance, well, you were a McCarthyite. Shut up. If you proved that their leniency toward criminals turned our cities into cesspools, you were a fascist. Shut up. When you pointed out that their welfare policies destroyed black families and created a social disaster of vast proportions, you were a racist, a sexist, uncivil, worse than Hitler. All just different ways of saying, shut up. All around the world, as leftism has failed everywhere, shut upery has been called to its defense. The full-blown leftists, the communists, say shut up with prisons and guns. But the Western leftists, laboring under traditions of freedom, are subtler. In Europe, they've had more than 50 years of the sort of soft socialism the Democrats are now bringing here. Their anti-individualist, anti-religious, anti-patriotic policies have so sapped the energies of the European nations that the continent's once great cultures are now flaccid and passive, fit for nothing but to be conquered in slow motion by the violent, intolerant Islamist invader within. But when people like Ayn Hirsi Ali, Geert Wilders, or Oriana Fallaci have the temerity to decry the left's empowerment of Islamist hatefulness, they're the ones brought up on charges of being hateful, not because they're speaking falsely, mind you, but because, shut up. So now, the left is in charge of America, and shut up is on the march. Watch for that fairness doctrine. Beware of net neutrality. Pay attention to the ways the liberal mainstream news media distort, mock, insult, and exclude the conservative opposition. Listen to the people they don't want you to listen to. Whatever you do, don't shut up. Don't shut up. Don't shut up.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Now live from coast to coast and around the globe, more real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. You can listen to the show at lwrn.net or WIFL 104.3 FM in Florida. And our guest is Phil Hart. He's a representative in the Idaho legislature and an author
of a book called Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? And Phil's was kind enough to join us for both hours so we could get through a lot of this information. So, Phil, I wasn't able to tell you last time that the break came, so the listeners probably just heard you talking and then heard nothing. So if you want to just go ahead and continue with what you were saying, and then I know that you also were hoping to tell the listeners a little bit about what they can do to resolve this situation as well as any other ones with their own legislators in their hometowns.
Well, what I was saying was that in writing this book, I just used the tools that any legal researcher would use to determine the intent of a law that goes back in time quite a bit. And anybody who used the tools that I used and made the amount of effort that I made would come up with the same conclusion, because there is not some other body of evidence out there that you can find that would rebut what I've concluded, and there's really no way you could rebut it. You had a budget of $1 million, and you could go to every law library in America and try to prove the conclusions of my book wrong. You couldn't do it because the evidence is not there. And this book should have been written right after World War II, when Americans started paying an income tax on their wages. But it's a little disappointing that in the year 2000, when I was trying to get to the bottom of this, that this work had not yet been done. And that kind of brings up another point. Well, what can we do? And I can remember before I was an elected politician, I used to get mad at the politicians. Like, I want them to lead. I want them to solve all these problems. But now that I'm on that other side of that fence, I'm kind of disappointed in the people. The people have to make something an issue. And like I said at the beginning of the show, there might be 1 million issues that we need to deal with, but the only ones that rise to the top are the ones that the people put on the front burner through their interest and their activism and the things that they want to see the political branches take care of. And so it really kind of has to be a perfect storm before an issue rises to the top, gets handled, and gets resolved. And so the perfect storm has to be, a lot of agitation, a lot of interest, a lot of knowledge, a lot of debate that's happening out there in the public. And a lot of times, it's not that easy, and it doesn't happen that quickly. And one place I like to tell people to go to kind of think about how to deal with the income tax issue is that movie Amazing Grace. And, we spend decades fighting against slavery, and this income tax is a form of slavery. And when they, in the movie Amazing Grace, if you've seen it, it's about England in the 1800s as they wrestled with the slavery issue. And every time the anti-slavery crowd made a frontal attack, they lost. But they finally won on the issue by being creative and fighting it on a number of fronts. And that's what we need to do on the income tax. It's going to take a lot of activism, a lot of ideas, a lot of education before this thing is going to change. And we need to change it because, we're in trouble as a nation, and we're, we're taxing the things. Normally you tax the things you don't want, like cigarettes or alcohol or whatever, but we're taxing our jobs, and our jobs are going overseas, and we have high unemployment, and we're discouraging employment in the United States by this heavy-handed system of taxation and auditing and collection and reporting. And it's no wonder that people don't want to employ folks in America, and that we're sending our jobs overseas. And so we need to, get off the back of the American worker, let him keep his money in his pocket, quit taxing his wages, and, do a few other things to bring some jobs back to America and get our people employed again.
What specifically has gone on, at least in the time that you've served in the legislature in Idaho, relating to the income tax issue or the money issue, which we haven't talked about at all, but I'm sure you and I agree they're interrelated.
Well, I think we have an opportunity right now where there's more interest in what's going on in politics, but I think we need people who are willing to stand up and be counted, because there's a lot of folks that get involved in this issue, and they, for whatever reason, they just want to keep a low profile. They don't want their name on a list, or they just don't want to get involved. But this, we're not going to change anything unless a lot of Americans get educated and get involved. And, you know, I think it goes back to the golden rule where, you know, Christ said that we're to love our neighbor as ourselves. And, you know, when we stick up for the constitutional rights of everybody, that's really a form of loving our neighbor and defending their rights as we defend our own rights. And that's where this country came from. And, you know, I was just talking to some people about this. They're very, very knowledgeable about the income tax, and they said to me, well, I don't want my name on a list. Well, you know, I can think of another list, and that was the Declaration of Independence that was signed by 52 men. And, you know, they put their name on a list. And at the time, England was the government here in the American colonies, and when folks volunteered for the Continental Army, their name got on a list. And if we hadn't had people, you know, 223 years ago that were willing to put their name on a list, we wouldn't have been blessed with the Constitution that has done so well for us over the last 200 years. And so it's really time for Americans to quit thinking about themselves, but thinking about what we were given by our founding fathers and what we want to leave to our children. And if we're worried that our name gets on a list and somehow, you know, we've got to be careful, then that's not the country that I want to pass on to my daughter. And I want to do something about it as an adult who can get involved in the political process and who can try to make some changes.
Well, I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. I mean, I guess I would also, those that just can't seem to get past any fear of being on a list, I think that even though that might be the case, they can still get out there and help. There's ways to help without getting on a list, you know. You can send a little cash or money order to somebody that's doing, you know, that you support. You can offer to do work for a legislator, somebody like Phil, who, you know, only has so much time to devote to these issues. And you can do photocopying, or, you know, there's many ways that you can creatively, as Phil mentioned with the movie Amazing Grace, creatively help, and then eventually you may overcome your fear of being on a list. But on a list or off a list, you know, we need assistance. And as Phil said, there are Americans that came before us who were willing to put their name on a list that only had 52 names on it, or 51 other names. And people today, if they're going to be on a list, that list is going to have millions of people on it, and they're going to just go out and target you. You know, they're going to have to target everybody, and they don't have the resources to do that. So it's kind of time to get a little courage. I also agree with Phil that, you know, a great example would be Jesus Christ, who talked about, you know, giving up your life for another, to loving your neighbor as yourself. And he's absolutely right that we need to start thinking about our neighbor. And, you know, would you like, if you really like your neighbor to get ripped off and to get cheated by their government, then apparently you know, you're interested in getting yourself ripped off and cheated by your government. We're all in this together. And, you know, Phil's certainly done a tremendous amount of work with this book, Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? And I really urge people to get a copy of it. Phil, so we don't get cut off at the end of the show here, tell people again about your website and how they can get a copy of the book and how they can contact you.
Well, just one more point. You know, you've been in the freedom movement for a while, and you hear people talk about their issues when they fight the bureaucracy, and people want to say, well, did this work or did that work? And you know, I've got in my hand here a document that didn't work, and that's the Declaration of Independence. It was written, it was signed by 52 men. When the king read it, he didn't say, oh my goodness, these guys have got it right. They figured out what the rights of man are and what I've been doing wrong. You know, they are such bright men, I'm going to give them their independence. This Declaration of Independence didn't work. What had to happen is we had to fight a war, and we had to defend those ideas with our life, liberty, and our property. And it's the same thing today. If we're going to defend the Constitution, if we're going to defend our liberties, we're going to have to pay a price to do it. And, you know, your example of Jesus Christ, when he died, he didn't die for his sins. He died for other people. people's sins. And we have to get off of this mentality that we're just worried about ourselves. And we've got to think about our nation. We've got to think about our offspring. We've got to think about our neighbors. And we've got to defend not only our rights, but everybody else's rights. And none of this can be done by itself. Joe, you can't do it by yourself. I can't do it by myself. We need a lot of people who are active, who are out there trying to defend our rights and to give life back to our Constitution. Well, if you want to read my book or order a copy, you can go to my website, constitutionalincome.com. There's a order blank there that you can mail in with a check, or you can order it through PayPal online, and we'll get a copy off to you. And I appreciate your listeners that are willing to take a few hours at a time and get educated, but we've got a lot more education that needs to be done, and we've got a lot of work to do. So I hope those who listen today will get on with it, and we'll make some progress for liberty.
How can people support you? If somebody lives in another state, how can they support your like your political campaigns, or you know, is there a way that they can learn what level of support and what they need to do to support you?
Well, I've got a website for my political activity. It's Hart, H-A-R-T, the number 4, Hart4Legislature.com, and I've got my mailing address there, and if someone were to want to send me a donation, I'd very much appreciate it, because you know, it takes resources to fight these battles, it takes resources to get elected, and frankly, I can use all the help I can get.
Well, I got to imagine that somebody like yourself, who's a straight talker, you know, may not be the favorite of all the lobbyists with all the deep pockets. So, people, you know, need to remember that, and that, you know, these legislators who will kowtow to special interests, yeah, their bank accounts are always full. But those who actually speak their mind and are willing to speak the truth, especially about this research about the true definition of income and what the IRS is really up to, it takes a lot of courage. And a lot of times when you show that courage, you know, your bank accounts start to dwindle. So it's important for everybody to get out there and help Phil to stay in the legislature as long as he wants to. And I really commend you, Phil, for doing that. I'd like to just build upon what you said earlier, that, you know, the two greatest commandments that Jesus talked about was to love God with all your heart, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And I believe that if we implement that belief system in our daily lives, in terms of loving our neighbor as ourselves and doing unto them as we'd have them do unto us, that additional graces will flow from God to us by simply obeying that commandment. So start today to obey that commandment, or obey it more fully. And I agree that wonderful things can happen.
Well, Joe, I appreciate the opportunity, and you're absolutely right about that. You know, when we defend our neighbor, we're defending ourselves. And, you know, when we're in trouble, we want our neighbors to help us, too. And so that's one thing about politics. It's all about relationships, and it's about working together and getting things done. We've got a lot of work to do. We need a lot of people to help. It's not going to happen because someone had a silver bullet. It's going to take millions of people to restore our Constitution to us.
Absolutely. Well, Phil, thanks for joining us, and thanks to listeners for joining us this weekend, this Saturday. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you next week. Again,
Liberty Works Radio Network.
The American Dream was given birth by Samuel Adams, the father of the American